didn't say that and wouldn't give such a guarantee, I'd suspect a trap and wouldn't go there anyway. So Netanyahu will know that he's not he it would be a great risk. It would be for him to travel to any state party. And by the way, non-party states are not prevented from enforcing the arrest warrants of the court. They could do that as well if their legislation allows it, and might do it.
Could a country like Canada or Ireland or France exercise your universal jurisdiction and arrest a, I don't know, a senior Israeli military officer or political official who's not had a warrant issued against them under your universal jurisdiction?
Yes, a state needs to have operative legislation permitting the exercise of universal jurisdiction. So a country like Canada has such legislation. It's been applied in the past, and it's quite possible that Canada could do that. You have to make an exception for the head of state and the foreign minister and perhaps a few other very senior officials because they benefit from immunity under customary law. And I think that there would be a reluctance of courts to allow that to happen in a country like Canada based on the customary law of immunity. But when you talked about senior military officials, absolutely.
If Benny Gantz were to travel to France or to Canada, he's not had an arrest warrant issued against him. He was active in the 2014 assault on Gaza, which falls within the scope of the ICC's investigation. Would he be well advised not to travel?
Yes, he would be. I think he could be advised to travel. Most countries, including Canada, make an exception for the le such legislation, for universal jurisdiction legislation, and require political authorization for it. So again, someone like Benny Gantz would presumably be coming on some sort of an official visit, and so the government would be in a position to give him an assurance that he would not be arrested. Whether they would do that, I don't know. But they could say to him, and he might be wise to say to such countries, "Listen, I'll check these. You have to give me an assurance." And they might not trust it. So this has been going on for some time. I think a lot of senior American officials have taken care as to where they travel, and sometimes have refused to. I've heard anecdotal reports of certain American officials who won't go to an international conference and an academic conference because they fear that that there'd be some sort of activist initiative to get them charged. So yeah, it's possible.
What could be the consequences for American politicians who threaten Karim Khan and his family and the judges and their families, which is now happening?
Well, Karim Khan has pointed to a provision in the statute which talks about intimidating people of the court who are conducting their duties under the Rome Statute, and has said that people who do this could be prosecuted. Those provisions are used mainly for what we'd call contempt of court matters and things like attempts to corrupt witnesses and so on. And there have been prosecutions at the ICC for that sort of conduct. But there is none, to my knowledge, in terms of this idea of threatening or trying in some way to intimidate members of the court from carrying out their duty. And so Khan has invoked this and said, "I can prosecute you for it." I don't know whether I think it's probably questionable whether he can prosecute American officials for acts that are committed in the United States, because I wouldn't think that the Rome Statute's jurisdiction for such offenses against the court can be broadened to that extent. But it's possible. I mean, the Rome Statute talks about jurisdiction over territory and over citizens, but only for the core crimes of genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and the crime of aggression. And it doesn't really, I don't think, address the issue of jurisdiction for these crimes against the administration of justice. So maybe Khan has that in mind, but that it seems like a long shot.
Last question, Bill Chabas. How have recent events in The Hague at the International Court of Justice and at the International Criminal Court modified or changed your views on the relevance of international law in achieving peace and justice and just strength of international legal instruments and tools and institutions?
I think what we've seen in the last several months, particularly at the level of the International Court of Justice, but now with the engagement of the International Criminal Court, it adds to this, is that there's a very, very evident turn at the international level towards judicial means of addressing international disputes, particularly those that are that concern matters of human welfare, of human rights, of the humanitarian situation. And this is, it's not entirely unprecedented, but the volume of these cases, not just the ones dealing with Israel, but other cases as well, dealing with Syria, dealing with Myanmar, dealing with Azerbaijan, Armenia, and so on, it's really very striking. And a large part of this is because states are turning to the International Court of Justice in particular, but judicial means more generally, as an important way to address conflict, violations of fundamental rights, and so on. Matters that were traditionally dealt with at the political level through political bodies. And you still hear this when countries like Canada and the United States object to taking cases to the International Court of Justice. They use terms like, well, this is not helpful. This isn't going to help us solve these problems. They have to be done at the political level. And the reason why we're in court is because of the failure of the political level to actually deliver. At the International Court of Justice, there is no veto. There's no veto of the permanent members. It used to be, even a dozen years ago, it was a given that of the 15 judges, each permanent member was entitled to have a judge at the court. That's no longer true. It was never a rule. But two of the countries, the United Kingdom and Russia, no longer have a judge of their nationality at the court. And as people saw in the orders that were issued earlier this year in the case of South Africa, that the judge, for example, of the United States is clearly not following the foreign policy of the United States, but is ruling in a judicial manner based on her own judgment. So this is a new development. Will it continue? We'll see. But so far, the fact that the court, the International Court of Justice, we'll see about the ICC, is delivering the goods, is only an encouragement. And we'll see more of this activity in other conflicts in the future, because states find that there's, you know, they trust the institution to a degree. And they also are anxious to see issues settled based on principles of law. Sometimes they work in favor of the powerful states, and sometimes they work against them. The problem with the powerful states is they only want to use the judicial institutions when they are helpful to them and their allies, rather than the opposite.
Bill Chavis, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Nice to talk to you, David.
William Chavis is Professor Emeritus of International Criminal Law and Human Rights at Leiden University and Professor of International Law at Middlesex University in the UK. Among the 20 books he's authored, The International Criminal Court, A Commentary on the Rome Statute, and Genocide in International Law. William Chavis was named an Officer of the Order of Canada in 2006. You can watch my complete conversations with Toby Cadman and Bill Chavis at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, please subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about Earth systems, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Has followed the international legal dimensions of Israel's prolonged, effectively permanent occupation of Palestine more than Michael Link. Link is a retired professor of law at Western University in Ontario between 2016 and 2022. Link served as the 7th UN Special Rapporteur on the human rights situation in the occupied Palestinian territories. The GPM reached out to Michael Link for his thoughts on arrest warrants soon to be issued against top Israeli and Hamas leaders at the International Criminal Court and about this past Friday's ruling by the International Court of Justice ordering Israel to halt its military assault on the southern Gaza city, Rafah. I want to ask you right off the bat here, ICJ President Nawaf Salam, a Lebanese gentleman, also confirmed today amongst the provisional orders, or wasn't an order, but it was a statement. He confirmed that today's orders have, quote, binding effect and thus create international legal obligations for any party to whom the provisional measures are addressed. Can you explain this to me? I mean, the provisional measures were addressed to Israel, but is one of the parties to which court is addressing itself today, I mean, is the United States or Canada?
Sure. It's addressed to, and it's addressed to the world. I mean, it's obviously focused on Israel. Keep in mind that that provisional measures and other orders of the International Court of Justice are legally binding. Now, the court doesn't have its own police. It doesn't have its own army. So it depends upon either A, the country or state or organization to whom the order is directed to obey the order of their own free will with respect to what the court has directed them to do. And if they don't, then the enforcing body would be the UN Security Council. When the International Court issued its original order on the South African application at the end of January, this went, you know, Israel said, oh, we're complying with the order, and then continued on with its military offense, including, you know, the gradual reduction of humanitarian aid during February that was going into Gaza. So Algeria, an elected member of the Security Council, introduced a motion at the UN Security Council demanding an immediate ceasefire and demanding that all aspects of the order of the International Court of Justice be implemented. That was vetoed by the United States. And so then South Africa went back in March saying things have gotten worse. The court essentially just said, Israel, obey the orders that we issued in January. But at that time in March, seven of the 16 judges said that they would have supported an order for an immediate ceasefire. So now we come to the South Africa's third trip to the court, made arguments earlier in May. And now the court has issued this order demanding an immediate halt to the Israeli military offensive in Rafah in the south. And it's done that because we know that there are somewhere in the range of between 800 and 900,000 Palestinians that are fleeing or have fled from the south, but are still caught there. There's still several hundred thousand Palestinians still in Rafah, where Israel is promising a major military offensive. And where these Palestinians are fleeing to, there's no infrastructure to be able to handle the key issues with respect to healthcare, food, water, fuel, sanitation. So this is just, you know, with every move that these people have made, and it's probably for some of them their fifth or sixth exit, the conditions surrounding them are getting more precarious and more dangerous.
And the court, following South Africa's May 10th application for additional provisional measures of the court, which the court heard, what I gather was a kind of, and really, really rapidly, the hearing was held early the following week. Mm-hmm. And the court instructed Israel to file a report within 24 hours mm-hmm. of what it was doing to ensure that people were able, the Gazans were able from Rafah mm-hmm. to escape, evacuate yeah. safely. Conditions were in Al-Mawasi. Mm-hmm. And one can imagine what the Israelis must have told the court. They must have told the court everything is peaches and cream, and we're just bending over backwards to help out, and there's no mm-hmm. no problem at all in Al-Mawasi. And then mm-hmm. South Africa had the chance to reply over the weekend. They had a couple of days to reply. Now the court has ruled.
Yes, so the ICJ does have the Israeli and South African written statements that were submitted to the court. I didn't look yet at the Israeli statement. The South African statement is 61 pages. you know, thoroughly researched and densely documented and cited. And at the end of the day, what's going to persuade this court with respect to what's going on in Gaza is our documents and statements coming from the United Nations. That it that the court accepts is a truly neutral, respected authority for any of the orders that's going to wind up considering to make. Israel, when it made its presentation in front of the court and in terms of its written documentation, you know, did not barely cite it, the United Nations, and was mostly making assertions with regards to all the things it said it had done, all the protections it said it had offered, all the safeguards it said it had ensured, where South Africa was rich either in international media reports or reliance upon UN documentation. And that, from what we saw in the statement today issued by the president of the International Court of Justice, it's what's most persuasive to the court. And that's what it relied upon. It's what's relied upon in each of the decisions and orders that it's made in January, March, and again today. And the three main things it said is, first of all, Israel halt its military offensive and any other actions taking in Rafah. Number two, it said, Israel, you must maintain the opening of the Rafah crossing, which, as we know, has been either entirely shut or barely open since Israel took control of the Palestinian side of the Rafah crossing several weeks ago, and I think it was around the 6th of May. And the third thing they said is, take effective measures to ensure the unimpeded access to the Gaza Strip, you know, for any investigative body that's been mandated by the UN to investigate allegations of genocide. Now, and I suspect none of these three orders will be put into place. Indeed, there has been reports in the last 2 hours of substantive military firing and missile attacks in the Rafah area, which is, you know, Israel's response to the ICJ orders. You know, there's very little hope, you know, probably less than zero, that Israel will obey what the court has ordered. There's very little hope that if a vote is held either at the General Assembly or at the Security Council, which demands Israel implement an immediate ceasefire, even if it's just limited to Rafah, that Israel is going to wind up obeying. Israel has a long record of disobedience of UN resolutions and of provisional measures coming from the International Court of Justice.
And it's totally accustomed to impunity. And so not only does it believe down to its very core that it has the right to do anything it wishes and not to do anything it wishes not to do, it's also completely accustomed to simply defying resolutions of UN Security Council and getting away with it. There are no consequences ever. And so Israel responds to things like today and the most recent turns of events by just going crazy and escalating its actions because it thinks it can get away with it.
Yes, and that's because of its extraordinary relationship with the United States. Israel is a, even though it's a very well armed nuclear power, it's a very small state, and it would not be able to do the things it has done with respect to defying resolutions coming from the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, the General Assembly, particularly coming from the Security Council, or orders coming from the International Court of Justice, unless the United States was fully behind it with regards to this. And I haven't seen remarks yet coming from the United States today, but I think I can almost write them with respect to what the U.S. will say with regards to Israel's conduct of the war. And the United States itself has to realize, and I think it does realize, that its reputation is also sinking on the international stage, given the fulsome support militarily and diplomatically that's been given to Israel over the last 7.5 months. But I don't think that dissuades the United States. And certainly accusations of double standards with respect to how the United States argues international law with regards to Russia's invasion in Ukraine and Israel's conduct of its war in Gaza and its forever occupation. That's rarely ever dissuaded the United States from continuing to offer full backing to Israel, so that Israel knows, as you've said, that there's no cost to its maintenance of the occupation and its conduct of the war in Gaza.
So getting back to this quote that of yours and others that I love, why justice is closer to power than it is to law.
International law is closer to power than it is to justice in the Middle East.
And so here we see increasingly international law presented by the highest of international legal institutions, the UN's top judicial body, and the primordial central venue for international criminal prosecutions of the world, coming head to head with politics, as it happens in the United States. Mm-hmm. I mean, Ireland and Spain and Belgium and Norway and, you know, other countries, perhaps less so. But we see international law coming head to head with power and with power politics.
Yeah, look, in any system, domestic or international, any legal system, and at any time in history, there always is going to be a struggle, you know, some may say a dialectical struggle between law in the service of power and law in the service of justice. That always has been, and probably will be for a long time into the future. And we see this most when it comes to international law and Israel and Palestine. And, you know, what is hopeful, with particularly what we've seen this past week with regards to the international criminal courts prosecutor seeking an application to issue arrest warrants against leaders of both Hamas and of Israel with respect to the diplomatic recognition of the state of Palestine by three small but influential European states, and now this order by the International Court of Justice all in one week that there is a growing space for law in the service of justice. And the fact that in the short term, Israel doesn't feel compelled to obey or recognize any of these resolutions, any of these orders, any of these applications, doesn't mean that there won't be medium-term and long-term adverse implications for Israel. International law by itself will never liberate Palestine or deliver a two-state solution, but it will, I think, give strength to attempts by those who say either a two-state solution is what has to happen, or it's going to have to be a one-state democratic solution that relies upon the rule of law for all that live between the river and the sea. That's what I think. That's what I hope will be the progress and the meanings of this. You know, Lenin once says something like, you know, there are decades where very little happens, and then there are weeks when decades happen. And I think, you know, that possibility of rapid change occurring suddenly out of the blue, because of escalating events, may well be what we may see around the corner.
What's Canada going to do, and does it matter? What's the Trudeau government going to do and respond, and should we care?
Does it matter, I guess, is the question. Look, the Canada, you know, the governing Liberal Party is to some degree quite reflective of Canada. You know, Trudeau the senior helped to open up Canada's doors with respect to immigration, particularly coming from places other than Europe 45 and 50 years ago. And that meant that Canada now has very large diasporas from Asia, Africa, the Latin America, the Caribbean. And they have a different point of view, having come out of colonialized situations of Canada and its place in the world. And that's reflected in members of parliament in the Liberal caucus who come out of these communities, particularly in large urban areas like Montreal, Toronto, and Vancouver. And they see the conflict, they see the, you know, unfolding genocide in Gaza and the forever occupation in the West Bank and East Jerusalem through a different lens than the Liberal Party and certainly the Conservative Party have traditionally seen it as. So that's marked a difference. And, you know, Trudeau, while his inclinations would be to very strongly support Israel, you know, is recognizing how the balance of power is shifting. 1% of the Canadian population is Jewish. And I know we have a relatively conservative Jewish population. 5% of the population is now Muslim. I don't know quite what the percentages with respect to the Arab population. But certainly that begins to mean something in how the discourse is changing. It's not yet reflected in mainstream media in Canada, but it will probably in the years and decades to come. But it's certainly reflected on our university campuses. And I've seen that certainly with my, you know, what's going on at Western University, to see all of these bright, articulate, energetic, compassionate, dispassionate students of color, many of them coming from Muslim and Arab backgrounds, who are staffing and maintaining and expanding, you know, the student encampment here at Western University.
Michael Link, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me, David. Always a pleasure.
Michael Link is a retired professor of law at Western University in Ontario between 2016 and 2022. Link served as the 7th UN Special Rapporteur on the human rights situation in the occupied Palestinian territories. Watch my complete conversation with Michael Link at greenplanetmonitor.net. For today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, I've said it before, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
The SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance, referred to as DNA, is a student-led network of community members who identify as disabled, autistic, neurodivergent, deaf, MAD, and or as having a disability, a chronic illness, long-term condition, or a mental illness. At DNA, we work together to create campus change. We address ableism, and we promote disability justice while opposing oppression in all of its forms. We are the SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance. We are DNA. We provide support for students who are having difficulty with their schooling or accessing the services they need. Email access@sfss.ca or drop by the DNA Resource Center, room 1300 in the sub-building. That was access@sfss.ca, room 1300 in the sub-building.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Most planes are powered by jet fuel that's made from petroleum. But those same planes can be powered by what's known as sustainable aviation fuel, or SAF.
A fuel that is basically chemically identical to fossil jet, so that it can be dropped into any airplane and fly just like fossil jet does.
Kim Carnahan is with the Sustainable Aviation Buyers Alliance. It's working to increase the use of SAF to help the aviation industry move away from fossil fuels. Most SAF is made with organic waste, like fat from beef processing plants or plant residue left after crops are harvested. Some is made by combining hydrogen with CO2, which can be captured from factories or power plants.
So there's a lot of different things you can make this fuel out of.
The climate benefit depends a lot on how it's made. For example, developing new farm fields to grow crops solely for SAF production could increase deforestation, erasing much of the climate benefit. SAF is also currently very expensive, in part because the market is so small. So Carnahan's group is driving investment in SAF that meets high sustainability standards to help increase production and reduce the cost of cleaner aviation fuels. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.